My name's Joan Hunt, and we're engaged in a study of covenant in the Old Testament, dimensions of the covenant. I'm a pastor in Portland. I'm working a campus ministry right now, and I haven't yet got many opportunities to teach, so it's really a treat for me to be able to bring some of these things together. In teaching about covenant, I'm reaching back to some studies that I did before and during seminary that changed the way I looked at covenant. It seems to me has not become public and wide knowledge in the church. And I don't know why, because a lot of this research is 20 years old and more now. And I'm often baffled at the kinds of things that can be learned and that can really make sense, and how they seem to fail. I mean, they just don't crack the usual ways we have of looking at things that are traditional, when it seems to me that some of these newer ways, which are really old by now, have the potential of unlocking some secrets for us, or of making some of these concepts much more rich in their depth and dimension. One way we try to look at covenant that makes it more rich is to compare with the actual covenants that were written in ancient times. We have a lot of covenants that were written in Western Turkey by the Hittite Empire. And that gives us an idea of what the standard format was. When we know what they were doing to make deals among peoples at those times, and then we look at the Bible, some of the things that are spelled out there become clear as part of this standard form, and also some things that are kind of mysterious, we can fill in some of the gaps. And it's also possible to see the real fresh uniqueness of the experience of the people of Israel that they had in establishing, or in God establishing, a relationship with them. Because although they may use aspects of this standard treaty form, for instance, there's something so breathtaking about the idea of having a treaty between God, the only one who is divine, the only one who is and was and will be, you know, the God who lives, Yahweh, I am who I am, and humanity. It's not just between a great and powerful king who's got soldiers right there. I mean, it's a wonderful concept. And it's also a wonderful concept because of the kinds of things that God insists upon in the covenant. In the covenant at Sinai, that we spent some time looking at yesterday, if you were able to be here then, God is not just asking for loyalty from the people, although that is important. But God is also looking out for the people's relationships with each other and with any who may come to their community, with potentially all who may come to their community. God is not just concerned for self-glorification and grandiosity, but is concerned for justice, compassion, mercy. And one of the themes that gets going in the Sinai covenant is, just as God redeemed Israel from slavery in Egypt, so Israel, now when you live, if someone comes in who is in need of redemption, or someone comes in who is a stranger, someone comes in who is a foreigner in a strange land, just as you were slaves in Egypt, you see to that person or those people, make sure that they're included, that they're protected, that they're not going to be ripped off or taken advantage of. And so the covenant is set up as a way of humanity living in the image of God. God is a covenant maker, therefore we are covenant makers. God observes the covenant, therefore we observe the covenant with one another. Now, we're familiar by now with the idea that the Bible is made of many layers and strands, kind of like a geologic formation almost. If you go out on a geology walk with one of the experts in the village, the person might point to a hillside and say, here you can see all the layers, and this color is this kind of rock. If you've been to the Portal Museum, you've seen the diagram of what's inside of Copper Mountain and the different layers of rock that are in there. The Old Testament was kind of put together that way, laid down in different layers of sediment. Some of them are older and some of them are newer. And at some point, the editors or writers got together and put the whole thing together in a great longer narrative. But some of the older pieces are still visible in there. And That accounts for some of the reasons that sometimes there seem to be contradictory versions of the same story. Did you ever notice that Noah, when you read the story of Noah, he's taking in a pair of every animal in one version, and then a paragraph later he's taking in seven pairs of all the clean animals and one pair of all the unclean animals. So what did he do? Take in seven pairs or one pair? And it seems to be that they didn't want to get rid of any versions of the old stories, and so they put them together the best they could, but each one slants a little bit different light on the subject. So we think that a group of theologians called the priestly writers put together a lot of our narrative of the first five books of the Bible the way it is, taking these old materials and welding them together. And it seems that the priestly writers have organized the beginning of the Old Testament, the book of Genesis and Exodus at least, around three covenants. Creation isn't seen as a covenant. Creation is just a given, and the relationship that is established with people at creation by God is the free gift at the beginning. Covenant, the idea of covenant comes up when a relationship has been broken and it needs to be re-established again or established on a new basis. And so the first covenant in the Old Testament is the covenant that God makes after the flood with Noah. And not only with Noah, but I've been surprised and pleased to notice that the covenant is with Noah and the animals and the birds and all the living creatures. And I think if God were making that covenant now, it would probably be, and the waters and the air and the planet Earth. It's a very universal covenant, and it is universal. It's for everyone. And God is the one making a promise, really. The one who has to keep the obligations of that covenant is God. We'll look at that covenant on Friday, if you're able to come then. The next covenant that's made is a little narrower in scope. It's the covenant with Abraham in Genesis 15 and 17. There are two versions of the covenant with Abraham. It's narrower in scope because this is for a certain man and a certain portion of his family. It's not even for all of his descendants. It's for Abraham and the children and grandchild and great and grandchildren and great-grandchildren that come through Abraham and Sarah, not through Abraham and Hagar, by whom he had another son, Ishmael. And that promise carries down then from Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and so on. That's the promise and the covenant that we'll be looking at today. And then the third covenant is the covenant that God establishes not just with one man and his descendants, but with all of Israel, who are the children of Abraham, but even more people who weren't related by blood in the covenant at Sinai, Exodus 18 to 24, that we looked at yesterday. Now, if you had to weigh the relative advantages of these covenants, what good features do you see about each of them that you wouldn't want to live without? Or another way to put the question is, if you had to pick one, or if you had to rank the three, which you think is the most important, and which one might be the least important, if you can do that.
Abraham's so personal in one sense, and Noah is so now because of all of our environmental problems, and Israel is so inclusive that the ranking would be possible.
Ranking would be hard, wouldn't it? Yeah.
One, is it a rank? I just got, so you're this is the first time thinking this through, and to me, my first reaction is not ranking those of the human aspect, but to me the most important is that God is the covenant provider. That's the only way it's going to be a covenant.
She squirmed out of it.
I know I did, because I have. I keep going back to
that. So you're saying something that's common about all three of them is that each one is an expression of God's will, and if God's providence, God's providing.
Right. And without that, there won't be covenants. Mm-hmm.
With Abraham, too, wasn't he saying, I'm going to bless you and all nations,
right,
which is like this relationship of, I'll bless you so that you will be a blessing, you'll be a light to everyone else, mm-hmm, the relationship thing. So I would kind of go for that one first. Did the priestly writers, which one did they pick up on and change? Or
they've provided us with all three. They've organized this whole history around each one of those. And as to which one they thought was most important, probably Abraham. Because it seems like the priestly writers, they've kept Sinai in there, they've put it in its present position, but in the words, the editing that they've contributed, they avoid using the word covenant about Sinai. To them, what happened at Sinai was broadening what had already happened to Abraham, so in a sense it was nothing new.
Did the priestly writers write during the Babylonian captivity?
Yes.
And so things were getting out of hand, everything was spread out. Let's get back to these
old
days.
There was a real problem of identity when they were prisoners of war in Babylon. Even if they were treated fairly well by Babylonian society and they were able to find a place as merchants or artisans, then there was the danger of just kind of forgetting that they were Jewish. And how are they going to remember? The priestly writers tried to help people remember their Jewish identity by describing their history in a way that they hoped would be very attractive. And some of the things that really became insisted on were observing the Sabbath.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because that's when you'd get together with these priestly teachers who would remind you who you were so you wouldn't lose your identity. And another thing that was very important was circumcision. Why? Because the Babylonians didn't circumcise their men. And so if you were going to the public baths, say you were going to the sauna with the Babylonians, you gave actually a testimony to your faith by the fact that you were circumcised. And you can imagine young men saying, well, no one else is circumcised.
Well,
you know?
Do I have 15?
I'm going to stand out. Everybody's going to know that I'm not Babylonian. And then the priestly writers or priestly leaders are going to say that's the point.
Mm-hmm.
It's important to be part of this covenant, and here's why.
Didn't they actually rewrite stuff so that people at that time would pay attention again?
Yeah.
We would go back.
The stories are always told from a point of view. And so when these ancient stories are told, they're told in light of how it affects us. Now, that's why jokes come in and go out,
mm-hmm,
you know, because sometimes they deal with what is happening in our lives and sometimes they don't. And so there's this whole process of telling and retelling and retelling that goes on in the Bible. I don't think it changes the meaning. I think it sees new meaning in an old story for a new situation. What it's saying is, this is, yeah, go ahead.
Why didn't Adam and Eve get this picture?
When did Adam?
Wasn't that a covenant?
Adam and Eve, it's not called a covenant, but why do you think it's like a covenant? I mean,
because there's a promise there, and yet there's, it's the start of the promise.
Yeah, it is.
it's agreement with man, and it's a, but I guess there's no men, you know.
Here's the question. What do you think is the difference between a promise and a covenant?
Covenant's after the promise has been broken.
Mm-hmm.
Restore, redeem.
Well, covenant is like a contract, something for something.
Mm-hmm.
That there's a promise made, but there isn't an agreement to be kept by the other side as well.
Responsibility on the side of both.
On the side of both, in the case of Sinai, not in the case of every covenant in the Old Testament, as we will see as we go through the one to Abraham. It occurs to me, in your asking that question, that we make promises to people when there's already a relationship of trust. So the relationship is there, And the promise grows out of the relationship. I mean, that's the kind of relationship that God and Adam and Eve had, was one of closeness and trust. And it was that relationship that was broken. And the covenant actually tries to reestablish the relationship as well as reinstate promises and response to the promises. So maybe my thinking would go kind of that direction. Is that, anybody want to say any more about that? Let's look at this covenant between God and Abraham. Please turn to chapter 15. Now God has given a promise to Abraham. That was at the beginning of chapter 12, what we call the call of Abraham. The Lord said to Abram, "Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you." And here's the promise God makes then. "I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. The one who curses you, I will curse. And in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed." So this is a promise of land. I'm going to give you a land. I'm going to show you a land, and you'll be a great nation. It's a promise of blessing, and it's a promise of being a vehicle of blessing. And this is going to happen through Abraham and Abraham's descendants. So, right here now, in chapter 15, the Lord reiterates this promise to Abraham. Would somebody read verses 1 through 6 of chapter 15, please? Oh, well, let's do this dramatically. Let's have a narrator and have Abram and have God. Who would be Abram? Oh, come on. Oh. All right. You're Abram. Will you be God, please? Will somebody be the narrator?
I will.
Okay, great. All right. Go ahead.
"After this, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision.
Fear not, Abram. I am your shield. Your reward shall be very great."
But Abram said,
"O Lord Jehovah, what good are all your blessings when I have no son? For without a son, some other members of my household will inherit all my wealth."
Oh, that did combine. That combined 2 and 3. And a lot of our translations, that's a paraphrase, I take it. And a lot of, yeah, the Living Bible has made it understandable and left out some of the details. Namely, Abram is saying, right now I only have this trusted slave in my house, Eliezer of Damascus, and if I don't have some children pretty soon, he's going to get everything I've got, given property laws of my time. Okay, then 4.
"And the word of the Lord came to him,
this man shall not be your heir. Your own son shall be your heir."
He took him outside and said,
"Look toward heaven and number the stars, if you are able to number them."
Then he said to him,
"So shall your descendants be."
Abram believed the Lord, and he credited it to him as righteousness. He also said,
oh, stop right there for right now. We'll just go that far. The situation is that Abraham is getting a little concerned about this promise that God made and doesn't quite see how it's going to happen, and says, "Okay, you know, God, you've been kind enough to show up in a vision to me. Here's my question for you. When is this going to happen? Doesn't look to me like it's going to be able to be pulled off." God's answer?
Look to the stars.
Look to the stars. How would that affect you? How does it affect you when you go out here at Holden Village and look at the stars?
I weep.
Yeah. It's really overwhelming and wonderful. And to have that as a personal promise, you know, your descendants are going to be like that. Well, that's pretty darn good. Pretty impressive. But it's...
Tough to get at it.
You have to get ahead. Let's get this started.
They're a million miles away.
But God doesn't stop there. I mean, maybe if God had stopped there, it would have been a good idea. But then, now verses 7 to 11, please. And I need a different God, a different Abraham, and a different narrator to spread this around. Oh, don't be shy.
I'll be narrator.
Narrator? Be God? Abram?
I'll be Abram.
Okay, great.
Then he said to him,
I am the Lord who brought you from Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to possess.
But he said,
O Lord God, how am I to know that I shall possess it?
He said to him,
bring me a heifer 3 years old, a female goat 3 years old, a ram 3 years old, a turtle dove, and a young pigeon.
He brought him all these and cut them in two, laying each half over against the other, but he did not cut the birds in two. And when the birds of prey came down on the carcasses, Abram drove them away.
Now, if God had just stopped there with the stars, Abram would have been impressed, and maybe he would have been patient a little longer. God puts his foot in his mouth or something and says, I brought you from the land of the Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to possess. And that gives Abram another opportunity to challenge God and to raise his doubts and to say, oh yeah, prove it. And so God says, okay, I'll prove it. And makes the command about, or says, you know, here's how we're going to go about proving this. Bring these animals. Now, does this make sense to you? Okay.
The treaty.
Yeah, the treaty stuff.
The treaty ceremony.
Yes, make a connection.
Well, the treaty ceremony you talked about yesterday, when they would notice from their peoples that when there's a treaty between a powerful person and someone who's not powerful, they take an animal, they cut it in half, and they walk between it, and they run around it and things.
Yeah.
So this is a little tiny treaty ceremony.
That's right. That's right. It is a treaty ceremony. And it follows that standard treaty form. Notice God saying in verse 7, I am the Lord. That's the preamble, giving the name of the one who's going to make the treaty. The joint history is, I brought you from Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to possess. That's what's happened so far. So then the stipulations of the treaty, I presume, are maybe, I will give you this land to possess. But notice, who is the powerful party in the treaty, making the treaty with, or who has to keep the stipulations of the treaty?
I think it's God.
God is making God's own promise to keep. It's not, I've brought you here, and so you have to do this and this and this. It's, I've brought you here, and so now I'm going to do this and this and this. This is turning the treaty idea upside down or inside out. And really good noticing that the animal portion is connected with making the treaty very solemn, making it a psychologically significant event so that you won't forget it. Part of that is swearing that you're going to do it, and part of it involves this sacrificing of animals, taking an oath upon yourself. If I don't keep this treaty, may these curses happen to me. And or if I do keep it, may these blessings happen. Now, I just want to kind of raise the level of wonderment here by showing you some slides I took about 17 years ago when I was studying this passage. So let's have somebody turn the lights out and we can just close the curtains up to see these.
In a way, then, this doesn't really follow the treaty form that you mentioned yesterday, because it doesn't have any requirements or any punishment if you don't perform.
That's right.
In order to try
to understand this passage better, I went to a kosher slaughterhouse in St. Louis.
We can let daylight in again, too.
Does the fact that he didn't cut the birds in two and all that, does that make significance here?
I think maybe the birds were just too small to do it with. I don't know. I don't know the significance of that. And I've been wondering about the sentence, verse 11, when the birds of prey came down on the carcasses, Abram drove them away. Is that just a naturalistic detail, or is that a little bit of symbolism in it, too? I'm not sure what I'd think the symbolism would be. If you think of something, let me know. But now we'll continue with 12 to 16. We need just God and a narrator for this.
Well, the birds of, back to that, the birds of prey would be scavengers. To me, it's a symbol of bringing in, the concept of purity with the sacrifice with God.
Mm-hmm. So you don't want the sacrifice polluted somehow.
Yeah.
Sounds good, and I think we'd have to sit and think of the ramifications of that and try to find if there are other examples and so on and so on.
Well, one of the reasons why they do this too is to, there's a reason to see the animal is healthy too, the liver is okay. They have to know that there's two reasons for doing this ceremonially, and also if it's really healthy to
mm-hmm.
eat, and only certain people will. Knowledgeable enough to determine whether that animal is safe.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe if birds, they didn't need to do that.
Hmm. So that's why the birds weren't
cut. In a Muslim society, if an animal dies, the man has to go to the head of the village and he decides whether that animal is safe to eat or not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, let's have verses 12 through 16. No, let's go ahead and read right to the end of 21. But we only need God and the narrator. Okay.
I'll be God.
Thank you.
As the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and lo, a dread and dark, great darkness fell upon him. And the Lord said to Abram,
know surety that your descendants will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs, and will be slaves there, and they will be oppressed for 400 years. But I will bring judgment on the nation which they serve, and afterward they shall come out with great possessions. As for yourself, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried in a good old age, and they shall come back here in the fourth generation, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete.
When the sun had gone down and it was dark, behold, a smoking fire pot and a flaming torch passed between these pieces. On that day the Lord made a covenant with Abraham, saying,
to your descendants I give this land, from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates, the land of the Kenites, the Kenizzites, the Kadmonites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Rephaim, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Gershagites, and the Jebusites.
So there, your hunch is stated explicitly. It says, on this day the Lord made a covenant with Abraham. So that was the point of all of this. And look at how Abraham is when it happens. How is he?
Laid
out completely. He's not just... It says deep sleep in my translation, and do you remember someone else earlier in the Old Testament who was in a deep sleep? Yeah, the earth creature was in a deep sleep when the woman was made from the ribs. So, I mean, he's out of it. This is a very deep sleep. But also, it's saying this is really a creative time. This is almost like another step in creation, the creation of something important here. God is doing a new work here, and... the deep and terrifying darkness descending upon him, or however the translations put it, is somewhat reminiscent of the chaos that out of which God made the created order. So a new creation is happening here. or a recreation. And so Yahweh swears to Abram, know this for certain. And then there's a little bit of history there, prediction at this point in the story of what's going to happen in Egypt. But the people will be brought back here. Not right away, the Amorites aren't, we're not finished with the Amorites yet. In other words, they're living here and they're going to need to be moved out. But the people will come back here.
I'm confused by one thing.
Yeah.
The one place that would be oppressed for 400 years, but the other, they'll come back in the fourth generation. Now, four generations is not...
Yes. Again, it's being written... It's being pulled together after the fact. It's especially when we come to... or also when we come to verse 18, 19, 20, and 21, and we get this description of the land that they shall occupy from the river in Egypt, not the Nile, but one a little farther east than that, all the way over to the Euphrates, and the land of all these different tribes and clans. That is, in fact, the description of how big the empire was under King Solomon. Those were the people that Solomon ruled. There'd be two explanations for it at this point in the story. One explanation is that God predicted this to Abraham, and Abraham knew it, even though it wouldn't have made sense to him because some of these tribes weren't in existence when he lived.
The Euphrates is where we stopped in Iraq.
Yes. Interesting, isn't it? Yeah. It's still a great river. Or the other explanation is that in the hindsight of the people who put all these stories together, they knew that this was how the story came out, and that was how big the land got to be.
Like, we could write World War One now, but we couldn't have really written it in 1900.
Yeah. We could have said, uh-oh, it looks like a big war is going to come, and we're very frightened of what will happen. And we could even have made some estimates or predictions, but for accuracy, hindsight is the best. Well, I want to go back to this, to these animals, carcasses that are separated here, and the fact that Abram is completely knocked out cold, and what passes between the animals, the smoking fire pot and the flaming torch. What does that mean? Who or what is passing between those animal parts?
God.
It is God. What makes you think it's God? The presence of God.
Well, it's like what led them through the wilderness.
God is associated with fire, the fiery pillar by night.
The burning bush.
The burning bush. So, tongues of fire at Pentecost, to pick a New Testament story. The lightning and the bright glory of God on Sinai. Fire is a symbol of God. So, God's own self is passing between the parts of the animal. Now we go back to treaty form.
Isn't that an anomaly then, because the maker is passing between them instead,
yes,
instead of the person?
Yes. Yes. I think this is a breathtaking and brilliant overturning of the whole idea of covenant, or reuse of the covenant idea. Because the powerful king, instead of saying, you're going to walk through these parts here because I'm going to rip you in two if you don't keep your part of the bargain, the powerful maker of the covenant is saying, may I be ripped in two if I do not keep what I've promised you.
And you can even languish in a deep sleep.
Yes.
You're so comfortable.
Because it depends on my initiative, my grace, my unilateral, unconditional love for you. That's how you could be sure, Abram. Because I say I'm going to do it, and I'm willing to take this curse on myself.
So this is a form of grace then, without a requirement.
Yeah. Yeah. Did God keep this covenant?
He did. There's a lot of people out there.
And the people at David and Solomon's time were even sitting there saying, see, it has been fulfilled. They knew the fulfillment of this.
The Muslims count themselves as descendants of Abraham as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. When this is making a leap to the New Testament now, but when did God ever bring the curse on God's own self for the breaking of the covenant.
Christ.
Was that fair? I mean, this is a self-curse saying, if ever I fail to keep the covenant, I deserve to be ripped in two. And what we have is Jesus who was ripped in two, as it were, on the cross, without God ever having broken the covenant. And so once more, there's kind of a reinterpretation of this covenant idea in another new breathtaking and spectacular sort of way. That the one who wasn't guilty still took the penalty or took the consequences of the covenant being
became
broken.
Became the sacrifice.
Became the sacrifice.
Made the cross.
And so, you know, you see why I think that it's how the biblical record is different from the standard treaty form that is as exciting as how it's the same. We say that there are two kinds of covenants in the Old Testament. One kind is a covenant of human obligation. The people who are bound by the promise and threatened by the oath or the curse are people. And that's the kind of covenant that we have at Sinai when, and all of its various versions and reinterpretations through the years as they go back to look at Sinai and kind of bring it up to date for the times that they had then and bring it up to date for the new things that were happening. So there are covenants of human obligation. But there are also covenants of divine obligation, where the party who is bound in the covenant is God. And that is at God's own decision, at God's own initiative, at God's own promise, and at God's own expense.
Isn't that true of the rainbow of the Noah and the after the flood?
Yeah.
There's no requirement for that either.
Right. So, and it's also true, David would have us believe, of the Davidic covenant, the one that sets up David and his dynasty as the head of power. Those are all pictured as unilateral covenants on God's part. And so really the only exception is Sinai. Sinai is the only covenant of human obligation.
Is that because the priestly writers wanted it to be in the Mosaic covenant?
I don't know.
We want to get back to purity and save our nation, so let's remind the people of the laws.
Yeah, what are the advantages of a covenant of divine obligation? And what are the disadvantages? If God is the initiator and only God is bound, what's good about, what are the strengths and what are the weaknesses?
According to Abraham's case, the weakness was that God wasn't fast enough. He had to wait for God's timetable.
Yeah, Abram's role in this covenant was what? To wait around, to be a recipient, to be passive in a sense.
In the covenant without stipulation, graceful covenant, I will respond, I will give back to the community and to God out of joy. I'm not afraid. I will just be so full of grace that I'll love people.
If I can count on God and God's stability and steadfastness, then I'm free and joyful. Mm-hmm. So that's another advantage of that kind of covenant. Is there a danger of this kind of covenant?
Cheap grace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Say more about that.
Well, just that we can do nothing. We can just flaunt our grace and not respond or live, you know, however. Mm-hmm. Anything goes.
Mm-hmm. And so, in a way, the Sinai Covenant is the balance or the counterpart to that mm-hmm. cheap grace idea. It's saying, wait a minute, this is a weighty relationship. It has cost God this and this and this, or God has done this and this and this. Therefore, let's make sure that we understand this as a two-sided covenant.
There's a danger in the other kind, though, too.
Mm-hmm. What's that?
It's because they use the law as a weapon, mm-hmm. and so they begin proclaiming their obedience to the law and all, and making a big thing out of it. Mm-hmm. And they become self-righteous.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You lose sight of this unconditional grace of God.
So when you talk about those two kinds of covenants, it's almost like one we're talking Old Testament and one we're talking New Testament.
Well, except please notice we're talking Old Testament in both of these. Right. I think it's dangerous to relegate the Old Testament to something.
Right, but the way people look at it, they look at the Old Testament as law and the New Testament.
And they look at the New Testament as grace. And it's not fair, and it's not what Paul does either. We've got enough time to look at how Paul takes up this covenant of Abraham's in Galatians chapter 3. The issue in the Galatian congregation was what? People coming around and saying the right way to become a Christian is to become a Jew first. You can't be a Christian unless you've kind of had an apprenticeship as a Jew. And so let us circumcise all of you here who are males, and let us instruct you in dietary laws, and so on and so on. We'll live this regulated, you should live this regulated kind of life, and then you can gradually become a better Christian, because that's how you become a Christian, is through observance of Jewish customs. Paul is writing to this congregation and saying, no way, Jose. you don't need to become Jewish first. This is not by means of law, but by means of spirit. And it's really interesting how he picks up the covenant of Abraham, because he knows that the Old Testament pictures Sinai as a covenant given to the descendants of Abraham. And in a way, Paul is going to arch back right over Sinai and say, well, Abraham's covenant was really the covenant that counted. Given the two of them, Paul would pick Abraham in a minute. And look at verse 6, for example. Just as Abraham believed God and it was reckoned to him as righteousness, that's a quote from the chapter we just read, so you see those who believe are the descendants of Abraham. The implied contrast is not those who follow the law, but those who believe are the descendants of Abraham. And the scripture, foreseeing that God would justify the Gentiles by faith, declared the gospel beforehand to Abraham, that was in the section we looked at in chapter 12, saying, all the Gentiles is another word for nations, all the nations shall be blessed in you. For this reason, Paul doesn't like our arguments that hindsight is why they wrote it. He's saying God knew it way back then in Genesis 12 and was predicting that all nations would be blessed through Abraham, all the Gentiles. For this reason, those who believe are blessed with Abraham, who believed. Then there's a section about the danger about relying on the works of the law. And this is along the line of what you said. You know, you can start to count on the things you're doing, and you can be removed from this free and freeing relationship with God.
Self-justification.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then after a paragraph about that, that one ends with verse 14, in order that in Christ Jesus, this is even better, because I think he actually does pick up the imagery of chapter 15 of Genesis, where God passes through the split animals. Look at verse 13. Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law by becoming a curse for us. Even though God had not broken the treaty, God took on the consequences of the curse. For it is written, cursed is everyone who hangs on a tree, in order that in Christ Jesus the blessing of Abraham might come to the Gentiles, so that we might receive the promise of the Spirit through faith. Brothers and sisters, I give an example from daily life. Once a person's will has been ratified, no one adds to it or annuls it. Now, this is really interesting linguistic fact. The Old Testament word for covenant is usually berit. And when The Old Testament was translated into Greek so that a later generation of Jews who no longer spoke Hebrew would be able to read it in their own tongue, which was Greek. You know, Alexander the Great conquered the Mideast. He spoke Greek. All his soldiers spoke Greek. So everybody tried to learn Greek so that they could get along in this new society that they had at Alexander's time. And the Jewish people who'd been scattered around no longer spoke Hebrew either. They spoke Greek. They had to have their scriptures in their own language. The Greek translation of the Old Testament is called the Septuagint. And when these scholars who were going to make the Greek version of the Old Testament came up against the word berit, they had a lot of choices in Greek, the way we do in English. Pact, covenant, agreement, contract, all sorts of things. They picked a word, diatheke, in Greek, which also has the meaning of last will and testament. So it was a word that meant agreement, and it also meant will, or last will and testament kind of thing. Paul's picking up that double meaning to use it right here. I'll give an example from daily life. Once a person's will has been ratified, no one adds to it or annuls it. Now, the promises were made to Abraham and to his offspring. It does not say, and to offsprings, as many. We just looked at this, to you and your offspring, it said in chapter 15, I'll give this. And so Paul is one, and this is in clear contrast to how many stars are in the sky, you know. Obviously, when God was talking to Abraham, God was saying, it's going to be many, 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 many. Well, Paul is making use of the fact that this word offspring is a collective noun. It sounds like a singular, even though it means a whole bunch of people. It's kind of like humanity. We don't think of humanity as one person, but the word humanity is singular. Humanity is various in color and spread all over the planet or something like that. Offspring is the same way. It represents many people, but it's a singular word grammatically. So Paul's taking advantage of that and saying, well, see, God's talking about one offspring in particular. It's kind of a pun that Paul's basing this on here almost. And so Paul wants to say, and that offspring is Christ. And the reason he wants to make that one offspring Christ is so that this covenant can be universalized. It's not blood descendancy from Abraham. It's spiritual affiliation with Abraham by having faith in Jesus Christ. So in a way, bringing it down to that one offspring makes it applicable to all. And so he goes on to say that. And my point is this. The law, he means at Sinai, which came 430 years later than the promise to Abraham, does not annul a covenant previously ratified by God so as to nullify the promise. God ratified the covenant with Abraham. It was like a last will and testament in the sense that it could not be changed. Obviously, once a person is dead, the last will and covenant stands. So Paul's not arguing that God is dead, but he's arguing that the covenant God made with Abraham is unalterable the same way a last will and testament is unalterable. And since God ratified that covenant with Abraham, the law, 430 years later at Sinai, didn't do anything to change or cancel that covenant with Abraham. And God granted this to Abraham through the promise. Well, then why is there a law? He takes that up in the next section. But where he really wants to come down to is verse 29. So if you belong to Christ, then you are Abraham's offspring, heirs according to the promise. You too can leap right over Sinai and go back to the original, unalterable, unchangeable, unconditional promise that God made in the covenant to Abraham. And so our understanding of Paul is enriched by looking closely at the covenant with Abraham. And the next question to press all day long in coffee hour and as you're standing up and lying down and sleeping and however Deuteronomy puts it, ponder on this. How, when, where do we experience God's unconditional covenant with us? Thanks for your attention.
Thank you.